Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, which has been another chapter in our grand book of the cultures of consciousness today. I think like a lot of people who started reading comics seriously, not as when they were kids, when you're kind of growing up and going, hey, what's up with this? Can this art form still provide something for me? In the 1980s, when I was going back to comic shops, I, of course, read The Watchmen like everybody else. And it kind of blew my mind. I was into Thomas Pynchon at the time and Philip K. Dick and the use of symbols and the grit and the kind of chaotic deflation of childhood myths in a way that still managed to be mythic was really powerful for me. And like a lot of people, I went on and read a great deal of Alan Moore's work, and I'm happy to say that we're going to have Alan on the show today to talk about magic and place and underground comics and whatever else we're going to talk about. But he's definitely been one of those artists who has mirrored different things that I've been interested in over time, almost as if he's like, you know, scrying my own interests in paganism and in anarchism and underground publications and the return of the local and the mixture of popular culture and political subversion. So very happy to have him on the show. And if you are Twitterers out there, I'll be on my tweet account taking some messages and questions from folks. So if you want to sign up there, I'm Eric_Davis at Twitter, and that's E-R-I-K. And before we bring Alan on, I want to introduce, of course, the White Witch of Los Angeles, Maja Dow, who's probably extra excited about today's episode.
True, it's all true. Like you, I mean, I'm a huge comic fan, like gigantic, but I love esoteric comics. Like I was a big fan of like Mac White and, you know, all those old school undergrounders. So as soon as I got a hold of some of Alan Moore's material, I was ecstatic. And I remember the first time I read Watchmen, I was actually at debate camp. I was like 14 years old. So not only did I like comics, but I was also at debate camp. I know I'm divulging a lot of dorkiness, but I was just like so, it just broke open my mind. Even though I was into other underground comics, of course, I just loved how he integrated all of these magical, esoteric, symbolic ideas into the work. So I'm very excited to speak with him.
Well, you did some comics. You've written alchemical comics.
I did. It's true. I made a bunch of zines that were very successful that I just totally, you know, did on my own and Xeroxed old school style. So I'm pretty into comics.
Yeah, and there's something about the connection of the imagery, of the format asks for a certain kind of density of imagery that evokes magical thinking. Even if you're not into magic, there's something about it that has a kind of enchanted
like
quality. Well, enough of us gabbing around. Mr. Moore, thanks for being on Expanding Mind.
Hi, my pleasure. Good to be on the show.
Yeah, actually, you know, I got to tell you that the theme music was created by none other than Mark Pilkington, our mutual acquaintance.
Well, Mark is a man of many talents. What can I say? I really didn't know that music was one of them, but I shall have to congratulate him on that the next time I see him.
Yeah, he's got a whole bank of analog synthesizer gear in his apartment, and he does shows and makes soundtracks for odd insect movies and all sorts of wonderful things. And Mark is the editor of Strange Attractor Journal and the overall editor of Strange Attractor books. And the last issue 4 has pieces by both Alan and I. Your piece, of course, being the residue of the John Dee Opera Project. We'll talk about that in a second, but I wanted to start out with another thing. You're calling from Northampton, and I know that your that place means a lot to you. And it's woven itself into your work, you know, off and on, increasingly so in recent years. And there's a very strong sense of place, and you've meditated a lot about place through your work, through Voice of the Fire, the novel. But I think, like a lot of Americans, I know something about the UK. I've been there a bunch, but I really don't know very much about Northampton. So why don't you, can you locate us? Can you give us a sense of what it is about that place and your relationship to it that kind of continues to feed your work?
Okay, well, I mean, I'd say that all of my work is based upon, I suppose, my observations of the human condition, which, by which I mean my own condition. And it occurs to me that you really can't consider any human being out of their context. It occurs to me that the places in which we live are as much a part of us as our bone and hair and tissue. They inform everything about us. So I started, after being inspired by Ian Sinclair, who is probably, he would hate this label, but he is the father of English psychogeography, as that term is understood in the present day. And my earliest forays into that area tended, just by accident, to be about London. I was covering a lot of that stuff in From Hell, the Jack the Ripper narrative that I did, and in a lot of the magical performance pieces that I did, just because London has a wealth of venues and it's a kind of cosmopolitan city that is much more prepared to tolerate this kind of mad occult nonsense than perhaps more provincial places. So I've done a lot of coverage of London, but I started to think about the place where I was actually living, Northampton, where my family has lived for countless generations. It goes back at least to the early 16th century, and we can't trace it any further than that, but yeah, probably my family has always been here. So I started to have a look at Northampton, and I should say that, yeah, of course, I came to the conclusion that it is the absolute centre of the universe, and that everything was invented in Northampton. This I understand that this is probably a little bit subjective, you know, and that everybody else in the world could make just as good a case for the place where they are living. To which I would say, yep, go ahead and do that.
I think that's so good, because that's like the microcosm is what you're talking about, right? And it's true, the area where you are, especially when your family has been there for generations, it's literally like you said, like your blood and bones are intermingled with the soil, with the plants. Like if they grew stuff and ate it, it's like literally interconnected with that part of the earth. So that section does become a microcosm for the center of the universe, for you and your family. So I don't think that's subjective. I think it's kind of true.
Well, it is, yes, it has a complete truth, because, subjective truth is the only truth. I have never in my life seen an objective truth. I've seen ghosts, demons, maybe a flying saucer once, who knows, but I've never seen an objective truth. So we are pretty much stranded in our subjective realities, and I think that it would probably be to our advantage if we made those subjective realities as meaningful and as powerful and beautiful as possible. And I mean, with Northampton, once I started to look at it in the light of it being the center of the universe, I found, as you do, quite a lot of supporting evidence. With relation to America, both George Washington's families and Benjamin Franklin's families emigrated from Northampton around the time of the English Civil War, when Northampton wasn't the best place in the world to be, I have to be honest. And I believe that Washington's family, who came from Barton Soulgrave in Northampton, took with them the Barton Soulgrave village crest, which in English heraldic terms is referred to as bars and mullets, but is probably better known over there as stars and stripes. So it's very possible that the American flag is actually an expanded version of an obscure Northamptonshire village crest. And so, in a sense, yes, I think Northampton invented America. That's what I'll be claiming anyway.
That's a good... No, I could totally appreciate your approach to the center of the world thing, because I wrote a book on alternative religion in California, and I'm from an old California family, you know, which for us is old as it's, you know, 150 years plus. But I definitely came around this place where, like, oh, well, it's clear that everything it happens here. This is, you know, the invention of the future, basically. You know, it happens
absolutely
in California. And you start seeing everything through those lenses.
And if we understood that, if we understood the history and the romance and the fiction and all of the things that are attached to the paving slabs that we tread every day of our lives, then we would probably come to the conclusion that we were living in a fantastical and legendary landscape. And I think that if we felt like that for long enough, we may even start to feel that we were fantastical and legendary beings, because where we live does inform how we live. If you're living in a rat trap, then after a while you're going to come to the conclusion that you're probably a rat. I think that we have to reinvest the places that we live in and that we're probably bored with. We have to reinvest them with their information, with their history. We have to make them alive with meaning. And then the towns that we inhabit can all become William Blakean type residences that are full of legend and myth and story. And I think that we'd probably feel better about ourselves.
I think that's a wonderful comment. I mean, I've talked to Maja about this too, because she lives in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles is a very interesting place for me, because on the one hand it can be very alienating, and people who go there can have a rough time. There's definitely a funky side to living in LA, and the anonymity and the freeways and the sprawl, and it's just kind of confusing. But there's these incredible stories there, and all the people I know who live well in LA, they know local history, they know the stories, they know they have an enchanted... They have enchanted paths everywhere they go. And they might be tawdry stories. They might be funny stories. They might be political stories. It's not even so much about whether it's what exactly the story is. It's knowing that Raymond Chandler lived there, or they built the top. This is where D.W. Griffith built the stage set for Babylon. And this is where it moldered for years. Now it's a Vaughn's. And it just enriches life.
This is absolutely true. I remember that when I went upon one of the, probably the most important and certainly the most crippling physical walks of my career, I'd gone with Ian Sinclair on one of his psychogeographical hikes from his house in Hackney over to Mortlake in the west of London, which is the
place
where John Dee's remains are buried. So we were doing a little pilgrimage, but that took us all the way through London, all the way along the bank of the river, and doing that trip with somebody like Ian Sinclair is incredibly informative. He points to a piece of grating just set into the pavement on the other side of the street, and he says, oh, yeah, that's the grating that T.S. Eliot used to look up women's skirts through when he was working at the bank. And then he'll point to a stretch of pavement that we happen to be walking along. Oh, yeah, this is where they used to wheel Ezra Pound when he was ranting about his anti-Semitic conspiracies and all the rest of it. Every single paving slab suddenly becomes full of legends, and Ian is particularly responsive to the more the grubbier, the more forgotten parts of our cultural history. I mean, yeah, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, everybody knows about them. It's the lesser writers, the lesser poets and illustrators and musicians who fell through the cracks of history, who are the ones who are most in need of retrieval. And so, yes, often the most tawdry, the most low-minded, if you like, elements, they are all part of the picture. You can't discriminate and just pick out all of the radiant, spiritual, intellectual things. That is not the texture of voice. It goes all the way from the gutters up to the heavens. And you can't afford to ignore any part of it if you really want to kind of capture the human experience in any way, in any field of art.
Absolutely. Well, and there's really also kind of a politics to the to this localism. And I know you've talked about this some, about how we're at this very weird phase of history where there's been this sort of growth of this global awareness politically, economically, you know, over, you know, a few centuries. But it's really, you know, achieving a real sort of monstrous abstract quality, and that now there's this weird kind of return to localism in a lot of different ways, ecologically, politically, and that your magazine Dodgem Logic is in some ways coming out of that desire to kind of reconnect with the local that's happening in all sorts of different ways, and psychogeography seems like one of those ways that people have into it. So is that turn for you a kind of political positioning as well as a imaginative one?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I don't really see any distinction between any of the areas of my thinking. To me, whether I'm talking about magic, whether I'm talking about art, whether I'm talking about politics, it's all basically the human experience, isn't it? I think that all of this stuff that we call culture and consciousness, it all must have originated from the same point. I believe that it's my thesis, if you like, that consciousness, magic, language, and art all emerged at the same time, and that are all essentially the same thing. So the political dimension and the imaginative or creative dimension, they shouldn't be divorced from each other. The fact that they are probably explains a lot of our contemporary problems. I know that at the moment, I don't want to be a tease about this, but there's some interesting stuff going down here in Northampton. There's a kind of project that I've dreamed up with my collaborator, Mitch Jenkins, who's a wonderful photographer who I work with upon the Unearthing project. And we're now working upon a kind of a film project, a very small one to start with, but one that unfolds into a number of unusual technological and imaginative areas. I did come up with one idea that would actually have quite an impact upon this town. I proposed it. Both parties involved, including the town council, who I'm not on the best of terms with, I have to say, seem to be delighted with the idea. The council have proposed that I actually come up with ideas for ways to, say, keep the libraries open, because Britain is being rolled back in the current economic crisis to an alarming degree. We're losing half the streetlights in Northampton, I think, by the end of the year. Which will have an enormous impact upon crime and all the rest of it. So I am actually, although I do not vote, I'm an anarchist, I have always believed in direct action. And at the moment, I seem to be involved in an interesting sort of direct action, which is actually combining all of these elements, the imaginative, the creative, the social, and the political, making them all one thing, which I believe they are. I mean, the principle in alchemy, the fundamental principle underlying alchemy, is that of these two processes, solvay and coagula. This is pretty much analogous to analysis, taking things apart, that's the solvay part of it, and synthesis, putting them together in a new and hopefully improved form. And I think that this is the key to an awful lot of things, socially, politically, magically. To me, magic is a one-stop science of existence. It includes everything else within it. It includes creativity. It includes all human interaction. That's probably a very, very broad definition of magic, but it's the one that works for me. I don't think that we need to divide all this stuff up. I think that, indeed, it can be incredibly potent if we start linking areas of it together. That's my basic feeling. Was Marja about to say something before I started upon that rant?
Well, I mean, no, I mean, I was, but I think that what you just said was so true, because people think of the alchemists as these, like, you know, nincompoops that kind of were messing around trying to solve something, and then all of a sudden, like, science came out of it. The one thing they don't realize when they separate all that stuff, they go through, you know, the solvay aspect of it, they say, oh, we can just take chemistry out of it and leave all the other stuff that they were working on behind, or they'll look at Isaac Newton's stuff and they'll say, oh, well, the Principia Mathematica is good, we'll just grab that and leave everything else behind. But they don't understand, if you look at everything in totality, like, what were the things that informed those decisions of discovery? Like, what are the things that those were made up of, right? Like you were saying, with the environment, what's informing the individuals? That's how you get to the coagula point, is when you take into account the context of these things and start to organize them into that whole. Like, let's say someone's a scientist, but they're also religious, and they also have children, and they also have all these other aspects of their lives. Like, when you can take all those things into account, that's when you start to do the alchemical process. So what you're talking about with that action, like, that you're involved in, I mean, that is alchemy on a scale that happens in that microcosm of your environment. When you start to behave, where you put everything into context, right? That's when the magic, like, happens, because it's all...
Yeah. Well, alchemy on that level, it's simply combining the elements. And I think that, yeah, some parts of alchemy, they come from, as the name suggests, they come from Chem, which was the ancient name for Egypt. And it was the period when the Egyptians, or the people of Chem, were actually experimenting with all of these new alloys, these new forms of metal. They were discovering new alloys, and because of their worldview, they were connecting those new alloys with a certain planet or a certain feature of their mythology. Basically, that part of alchemy is probably metallurgy. The other part of alchemy, and to me the superior part, is metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of that they weren't talking about turning lead into gold.
Right.
And I don't know of any of them who were ever even reputed to have achieved that. What they were doing was turning the lead of the human spirit and the human situation, hopefully, into the gold of an elevated consciousness. And that is something, it's not just for alchemists, it's not just for magicians, this is probably the job of every sentient individual upon the surface of the planet. We're born into this world, it would seem incumbent upon us to try and make sense of it, and to try and function in it as helpfully and positively as we can. And on that sense of personal alchemy, then you need just your four elements, earth, water, fire, and air, which are all metaphors for their corresponding qualities within the human being. The earth stands for our physical circumstances, our physical body, the physical world that we exist in. Air stands for intellect. Water stands for emotion. And fire stands for the will or the self or the spirit that should be governing all of those faculties. So you take those four qualities, you combine them in different ways. Your intellect, your emotion, your physical world, your spirit. You combine these in different ways and you get gold. You get works of art. You get marvelous things. I mean, alchemy, the modern version of opera. I mean, yes, there has been opera since before the Common Era in China. But opera, as we understand it, was largely synthesized by Giuseppe Monteverdi, who was an alchemist and who was attempting to come up with some form of uber art that would combine everything from music to the visual arts to costume to drama to words. All of these other forms of art would be subsumed within a perfect art form designed to overwhelm the senses and to kind of create a fugue state in much the same way that the stained glass window light shows and the incense burning and the organ music and the sonorous incantation is meant to create a fugue state in the contemporary church. It's that illuminating state of mind which I believe is the purpose of all alchemy, and I think that's not something that's in the past. It's not something that is irrelevant. I mean, as you remark, people do tend to cherry pick when it comes to the past. I mean, as I see it, magic is the parent of both science and religion. Magic is probably one of the only ways that the schism between science and religion that we're currently going through could ever conceivably be healed. I mean, magic was, in its primordial form, our only way of negotiating with a frequently hostile universe. When magic evolved into religion and then into monotheistic religion, it was suddenly a very different thing. No one was actually communing directly with the universe anymore. They were communing with the universe through a middleman, through a priest figure. There was no need for them to have a transforming religious experience, such as the one that, say, Philip K. Dick had, because there's this book, and that's got stories about people who supposedly lived a long time ago and they had transforming religious experiences. So, no, don't you go having any transforming religious experiences. You just turn up for church on Sunday. With science, on the other hand, as you point out, I mean, Newton, himself an alchemist, who incidentally invented the colour indigo to fit in with his alchemical idea that everything should be in sevens. Now, clearly, there are six colours in the rainbow. There are three primary colours. There are three secondary colours. If you're going to give a name to the particular shade between one of the primaries and one of the secondaries, you could add colours to the rainbow for as long as you wanted. Newton was doing it because of purely alchemical concerns. Mm-hmm. And he famously said that he was standing upon the shoulders of giants. One of the giants that whose shoulders he would have been standing on would have been John Dee, who had was a true English Renaissance man, who had written the book literally upon mathematics, upon navigation, who had coined the term British Empire, and who I can still, at least momentarily, puzzle most Americans by asking them why exactly they fought their war of independence against the English.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever told them that England owned America? And the answer to that is, yeah, John Dee told them.
Yeah.
He made up or dug up an ancient legend about a Welsh prince called Madog, who had sailed with a company of druids and Celts all the way to America. And Dee's idea, which he put to his friend Queen Elizabeth I, was that by exploiting that legend, it would be possible to claim that all of the New World, as America was called then, was in fact English territory. And in fact, if we were to repeat that trick at various points throughout the globe, then Elizabeth I could very soon come to be running what Dee supposed you might call a British Empire.
Yeah.
So this is the magician at work. He was a man who made most of our modern world, certainly a great deal of its intellectual component. So you've got science and you've got magic. They are both like, you've got science rather, and you've got religion. Both of these could be considered as children of magic. But like many children, they feel embarrassed about their parents sitting there in the corner, sort of drawing shapes in the air, you know, with her third nipple, you know, and they would just like her put in some kind of maximum security twilight home where she's not going to embarrass them. But the thing is that, as with many of us, yeah, we might feel embarrassed about our parents at some point or another. As we get older, more and more, we come to resemble them.
Mm.
And I would say that science at the moment, which I keep up a very keen relationship with, is travelling into territories where even magic had not travelled conceptually. Science is every bit as mystical and strange as Renaissance magic used to be. Like mm-hmm. I say, as we get older, we come to resemble our parents. And I would like to see a point where all of these different social processes, whether that be science, whether that be magic, whether that be religion, I would like to see a point where they all converged.
I'm going to push on this a little bit about the convergence, and particularly think about the role that art or writing or graphic novels can play in creating a magical space, and particularly around this question of entities. One of the remarkable things about Dee, of course, is with however you assess his influence on history, and I agree with you that it's actually significant on multiple planes, you have this sort of core encounter, this fresh encounter with the angelic, and with this sort of information, this crystalline figures coming through a kind of deeply linguistic code, almost like it's a programming code to boot up some kinds of beings. And taking that idea there of just the sort of the angels encountered in ceremonial magic, and then linking it to this sort of issue of characters and figures in comics, just to take one of the things that has stayed with me the most from your work is some of the early issues of Promethea, where you show how there's simultaneously a kind of archetypal spirit, a god, if you will. But the life of this god, his characteristics, or goddess in this case, is thoroughly bound up with the history of its representations, with human beings at different phases of history, with different kinds of aesthetics, creating different contexts for this archetype to kind of embody itself. And both of these examples is this place where the mind approaches something like an other, like a divinity or an entity of another kind of realm, and something happens at that interface. So how do you approach that interface? How do you think about that interface, whether it's in magic or in your art?
It's something that I've been thinking of quite a lot lately, well, for years. But lately, I suppose, that the kind of conclusion that I've been drifting towards is that whether you're talking about creating a fictional character or whether you are talking about creating a god, and all of the gods must at some point in the past have been created as fictional characters, then I think that probably very much the same processes will apply in either instance. On my own experiences with apparent entities, they have seemed to possess a quality of animation. They seemed to be beings or intelligences that were outside myself, and yet, of course, I don't rule out the possibility that they were projections of some part of myself, or indeed that they may have been both at once. But in all of these encounters, or at least imagined encounters, a quality that I've noticed is that we clothe the entities that we are addressing in our expectations. That I almost have a sense that, as I believe a lot of the people who are looking into consciousness studies at the moment have concluded, I feel that there may be some, I don't know, a field of consciousness that perhaps pervades everything, that all that it needs is a receptacle to inhabit and to animate. I think that when we put together our ideas of gods, which perhaps start off in very simple form, but then will have more and more complex ideas and associations accumulated over the centuries of that idea's existence. I think that that's very similar to the process that we create a shape that, if this hypothetical animating force exists, then it can animate that shape. Once the conceptual shape, the idea shape, has reached a certain level of complexity, then it seems to be alive. We are told that one of the main theories in modern consciousness research and in cybernetics is that possibly consciousness and self-awareness is an emergent property of complexity. That when a thing reaches a certain threshold of complexity, it maybe becomes conscious. I know that over here, British Telecom, the main phone company, got so frightened by this idea of emergent consciousness that they wasted several million pounds trying to find out if the internet, which is a pretty complex thing, could become conscious. It was a kind of Terminator scenario that I should think that they were probably imagining. Although, of course, if they had been onto anything, then the phone network or the internet would have just sent a mobile phone back through time to kill them, presumably. But they eventually, of course, realised that Alan Turing who did most of his work just up the road in Bletchley, by the way. But Alan Turing had pretty comprehensively proved that with his Turing test, which is not really a test of artificial intelligence, it's more a proof that we cannot even tell for certain whether another human being is conscious. So how will we ever know whether a machine is conscious or not? So they abandoned their search for a conscious internet.
So, Alan, I'm getting a couple of some questions in on the Twitter, and I want to bring this up. And there's one that cuts to the chase, and this is from, you like this, Friendly Demon, who has quite a nice little evil gesture icon. And he's cutting to the chase in the following sense. Do you believe or not believe that magic is able to produce effects that defy scientific theories and explanations?
I do not believe that magic is capable of actually changing the physical rules of the universe. I would be definite upon that. I think that science seems to be the best way of explaining and predicting how the physical world around us works. I believe that magic is capable of causing incredible effects within consciousness that will then cause knock-on effects throughout the material world. I do not believe that magic will be able to repel gravity or to make you invisible to normal sight. I would cite the famous story about Aleister Crowley turning up, I believe, at the Savoy. He was completely naked, apart from a metal butterfly that he had taken off of Jacob Epstein's statue of Oscar Wilde at Wilde's tomb in the Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. And so he just got this metal butterfly over his genitals. And one of the couples dancing at this occasion where Crowley turned up said, the woman said, "Who is that? Who is that naked fat man over there?" To which her partner replied, "Oh, that's Mr. Crowley. I expect he's being invisible." this is a world with beautiful natural laws. I, for one, don't really have any particular urge to circumvent them. I think they're fine how they are. But the rules of the physical world are one thing. I believe that the world inside our mind is equally real, but in a different way. And that magic is the science of the world inside the mind. And
people always forget. They always want magic to be this, like, supernatural thing that breaks the laws of physics. But if you actually look at the laws of physics, they're amazing. Like, the kinds of things, if you perceive what's really happening, really in the world, according to the laws of science, it's completely magical. So there's no reason why magic should supersede physics when actually what really happens is magic. Now, that can be driven by our connection to the outside world,
this is absolutely true. And also, the things that people generally, if you were to ask them, what magical powers would you like? they'd probably say something like, "Oh, I'd like to be able to fly." Yeah, you know, all you have to do is buy a ticket on an airline. Yeah. I don't do it myself, but I understand that this is quite simple. You know, if you don't want to be seen by people, don't go out.
Yeah.
It's like, what, do you want to spy on them? Is that the idea of being invisible? Do you want to spy on them? I'm sure there's electrical equipment that you could, it's probably illegal, but you could do it, and it's possible. The thing is, all of these are fairly tawdry things that could easily be accomplished by other means.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that I try to impress upon people with magic. I mean, like, over here, from the 80s onwards, there was a school of magic referred to as chaos magic. Its main campaign promise seems to be that it offered a means of achieving your magical will really easily without doing much real work, simply by the application of Austin Osman Spare's Sigil system of magic. And generally the things being asked for would probably be, make this person fall in love with me, or get me some money, yeah, or punish these people who have offended me in some way. That would, I think, be the top three. And, like, if you want some money, perhaps if you were to actually do some magical work, then you might find that some magical money would pretty soon turn up in your magical bank account. If there are people that you want to punish, then don't bother the demons of the Goetia. You know, just get on the phone to some hired goon. Or you could go round and handle it yourself, or if that's absolutely out of the question, you could maybe even try moving on, getting over it like a grown-up. And if there's some object of your affection that you're thinking of perhaps casting a love spell on, I mean, isn't that what roofies are for? It would be preferable, a simple act of date rape, as wretched as it is, would be preferable to casting some sort of love spell.
And that all goes back to self-responsibility and, like, that thing of enacting your will. And ironically, the true magician is the master of their will. And, in fact, would never even need to do a spell to accomplish any of those things because they actually take action on their will. And that really is what, I mean, I think magic is, when you actually enact the thing, your potential of what you're supposed to be. And, I mean, to kind of, you know, tie that to what you were saying before and what Eric was asking about, with what is the connection between, like, drawing and graphic novels and characters and stuff like that. I mean, I wanted to just say that, you know, I love what you've said about the connection between magic and writing and drawing, and that act of, like, when you use a spell, not to have some end, like, make someone fall in love with you or make money or stuff like that, but when you make a receptacle to contain a vessel, right, like with Promethea or whatever, that when through writing or drawing you make that receptacle you were talking about, you know, whether it's the internet or whatever, to contain a consciousness, that through writing or drawing, which, I mean, drawing literally can mean to attract, like to draw a crowd, right? So when you draw, you're making that receptacle. I mean, what do you think about using magic? I mean, it's just shocking that most people don't realize they can actually use magic to do that instead. But can you talk a little bit about, I mean, how did you figure that out? What was your kind of main source that shifted between viewing magic in that very mundane way that a lot of people might take it and then actually seeing it in that other kind of way?
Well, I would have to say that when I first approached magic, it was with a certain sense of revulsion. I would, and this is probably completely unfair of me, and I was probably being incredibly judgmental, but I would find that in occult shops, a lot of the other customers seemed to me to be, rather than seeking philosophical knowledge that would help with their lives or insights into human existence, they seemed to be looking for some kind of secret knowledge or secret power that would plug some sort of, it seemed to me, emotional hole in their makeup. Perhaps they didn't feel special as human beings, but felt that some secret knowledge, some secret power would make them special. That didn't really attract me, and I tended to dismiss most of the occult as, yeah, this is probably wish fulfillment fantasies on some level or another. it was only when I started to encounter people like John Dee, people who were obviously, in their way, geniuses. I did not feel intellectually capable of dismissing people like that as delusional or as simply emotionally lacking in some way. So I started to have a look at magic as it existed in the early 1990s in Britain. I was very dissatisfied with an awful lot of what I saw. Like I say, it seemed to be largely pragmatic magic that was for achieving some perfectly mundane ends, which didn't seem to me to be worthy. But very early on, I made the equation between the art, as alchemy and magic were often referred to, and art. It struck me that if magic were regarded not as a religion and not as a science, because I don't think it should be a religion, and I don't think it can be a science, but what if it were regarded as an art? That would suddenly liberate all of the immense potential power within magic. What if, like, say, Austin Osman Spare, we were to turn our occult visions and the information that we receive during rituals, what if we were to turn that into a form of art? That shouldn't be too demanding, and it would mean that everybody else could see our visions in the way that we can see Austin Spare's visions. That would incredibly invigorate the occult scene. It would give it a purpose. It would give it a way of interacting with society. And it would also invigorate I don't know about over there, but certainly over here in England, a almost completely moribund contemporary art scene. Art really needs magic at the moment, and I think that magic really needs art. And it was once I'd made that connection that I suddenly saw how I could apply all of these magical ideas through the various media that I enjoy working in. Comics is a particularly good one as a medium. As an industry, I wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. But as a medium, I've come to believe that it's practically perfect for expressing magical alchemical ideas, because I believe that what we used to call the left half of the brain, I think that we've since learned that it's a bit more complex than that, but what we used to call the left side of the brain tends to govern our rational processes and our language centres. So you could say that probably words are the unit of currency that the left side of our brains runs upon. The other side of our brain is the pre-verbal, what we used to call the right side of the brain. I would imagine that if it's pre-verbal, then the image must be the major unit of currency. And it may be that comics brings together the word and the image in a relatively unique way. And I think it maybe engages both halves of the brain at once. And this might be the reason why a combination of pictures and words in comic book form will, according to the Pentagon, actually convey information much more lucidly and in a way that people will retain it. That might be because of this left brain, right brain thing.
Well, this brings up one of the questions that also is coming in from Richard Gere, and of course it's sort of remarkable that there's not just one very articulate comics visionary who's widely recognized who's interested in the occult and magic, but of course there's another one, which is Grant Morrison, who's just published a book on super gods, and he has his own sort of way of talking about comic art in terms of magic. It's just we're just talking. There's other media you work in, Alan, but we're talking about comics. I'm wondering if you have a sense of like a little compare and contrast with how you see the relationship of magic and comics with Morrison, since his he's articulating it in Super Gods and
I would have to say that I haven't read anything by Grant Morrison since his earliest work, which I didn't enjoy, so I'm not really qualified to talk about it. I would say that superheroes, I don't really think that they have any relevance at all to anything magical. Yes, you can make the fairly facile observation that, oh yes, there's lots of connections. The Golden Age Flash looked a bit like Hermes, had the same sort of helmet. You know, Hawkman was a bit like Horus, wasn't he? And these are contemporary gods, aren't they? I mean, like I say, that's a fairly facile observation. I would say that really avoids what superheroes are about at the moment. And I don't think that the modern superhero phenomenon is about anything very pleasant. I think that, as opposed to what superheroes represented to me when I was seven, where they were inexhaustible fountains of imagination. They put me in touch with my own imagination in a way that nothing else had at that point. These days, I look at an industry which, to me, and this is only my personal observation, but I look at an industry where the last time that anyone tried to form a union or to actually protect their own rights or, by extension, the rights of their families, their children, the last time that happened was in the mid-60s. It was all of the best writers in the comics medium, people like Gardner Fox, people like John Byrne. They were all fired and replaced by very eager and enthusiastic comics fans. At the moment, I see an industry of people who are writing about fearless, brave individuals who always stand up for the underdog. And yet the people running that industry and the majority of the people working in it, they're not interested in that. They will let the artists and writers that they professed to admire and profess to have been inspired by, they will let them go to the wall without a squeak.
Well, Alan, we've got a couple more minutes left, and I just wanted to turn it on a more positive note in the last mm-hmm. moments. You talked about when you were a kid, you know, that your experience of comics enabled you to plug into to really feed the imagination and to really kind of sustain it in a way. Where do you see that happening now? Where do you have a sense of, either through your own work or through work that other people are doing, where that kind of imaginal richness that is good for kids is coming from?
I am hoping that we are about to see a bit of a breakthrough. I think that, I mean, we're only 11 years into this new century, and in our heads, we're probably still back in the last one. I think that we have yet to get a handle upon what culture is capable of in the 21st century, but I think it will be coming soon. I think that regarding the imagination, I think that the imagination is possibly endangered at the moment, and I think this is a real thing. I'm not trying to be negative, but I think that we live in a society in which everything is over-imagined for us. This goes for the CGI effect in films, which, for all of their marvellous wizardry, are not as powerful as the images that you make in your own head while reading a book, where you are being asked to do some of the work, or a lot of the work, where the reader is engaged in creating the imagery and the world of the book just as much as the author is. That, to me, is perfect. I think that we live in an over-imagined world, and we haven't really got the hang of current culture yet, but I believe that there is still a wealth of inspiration in all of that great culture of the recent past and even the far past. And I think that what is possibly coming up in the future, the 20th century didn't really get going until the First World War. About 1915, that was the birth of modernism. You'd had Stravinsky doing The Rite of Spring. You'd got everything suddenly changed. We suddenly realised what century we were in. And I think that that sort of Renaissance moment could be just around the corner. So I am very, very optimistic about the future of culture, even though looking at it at the moment, I find much to distress and alarm me. I think that the right things are moving. We will probably be seeing something fairly spectacular within the next 3 or 4 years.
Well, with that wonderful prophecy, I think we're going to have to say goodbye. I want to let people know they can check out the dodgemlogic.com website. It's particularly entertaining. Alan, thank you so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Thanks, Alan.
It's been my pleasure, Eric, and you too, Marja. It's been great talking to the pair of you.
All right. Well, folks, keep your minds open.